All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. And we're beginning our month, our year-long exploration of these ox herding pictures. So for any of those who are new tonight, welcome. And I wanted to, we're going to do this a little bit late this year and use these pictures and these verses as the start of our meditation to help bring a quality of reflection and deepening around them. Then we'll do our normal talk and have a chance for us to dialogue around that. But let me just share that picture again and read the verse. So this first picture is searching for the bull. Sometimes the ox. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. Just taking a couple moments to really take that image in, take that verse in. And those will be available on our website. Actually already are, but we're still kind of refining the page, so you don't have to worry about searching it out. All right, so let's dive into this first picture. So the ox herding pictures, if you missed last month when we did an overview of these pictures, Tweri and I wanted to kind of dive into them. Rodney Smith looked at these about for a year, probably 10 years ago, something like that. And it's a Zen tradition, a Zen portrayal of the spiritual practice, the spiritual seeking that unfolds and all its different ways that it has met as different stages and different ways of manifesting. And so we want to try to make this a real engaged process for you by encouraging you to reflect on the pictures and the verses each month. And hopefully at the end of the month, you can even share some of your artistic expressions that come up around that. We'll try to figure out a way to do that through Zoom and through in-person meetings. So this first picture, the ox herding picture of searching for the ox. So I'm going to share my screen again as I read that one more time. So searching for the bull, the ox. In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. I cannot find the bull. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. So this is a very different way for us to practice, but just take a moment to take in that picture again. As I look at that picture, the first thing that comes to mind is that this person, or really representing us, we feel we're a little clueless, we're a little lost, or our feet are going one way and our head's going the other way. We're searching in a very confused way. We're kind of bewildered about what we're looking for, even what we're trying to see and what that represents. And this picture, I think, represents even the start of our spiritual journey, or even before that, especially how we swim in a sea of dukkha, trying to seek happiness, trying to seek fulfillment, try to seek escape from that dukkha, and how we often look in completely the wrong places. We just do not see where that might be actually present. So there's this level of confusion, of bewilderment that prevents us from really seeing clearly what's causing suffering and what potentially causes the release of that suffering. And the positive side of that causes the release of our heart's constriction, allowing our hearts to open, to have liberation arise in our hearts, in this very life, this very body. Now, this first picture strikes me. And again, I want you to spend time really reflecting yourself on that picture and what it represents, and more importantly, how it represents your own life, your own practice, your own spiritual practice. And the homework this week will kind of highlight that. But this person, again, representing us, that we're at this point, we're really searching for something, but we're not exactly sure even what it is. It's like we're looking everywhere for it, and there's all these brambles, all these river crossings, these confusing mountain trails, and we become exhausted in that search. Because there's something that's, I think, ultimately lacking in our lives. There's something that we sense is lacking, and we find so many ways to try to fill that lack, to try to find a way of alleviating that really deep sense of insufficiency. It's like, I need something, I need more of this, I need less of that. So the first verse, we're kind of go through this kind of verse by verse as we explore tonight. The first one is in the pasture of the world, in the pasture of the world. So the place where we reside, where we live, where we make living, where our relationships lie, where our work lie, our family, the things that we do in our world, our hobbies, our interests, the things we avoid, things we care about, this whole pasture of the world. So this is really, this first line really brings our normal existence right into the process. This is where we all start in our normal lives. And it's been said that this human life, this human rebirth, has the right amount of suffering and also the right amount of ease for us to actually have this beginning of this journey, this willingness to look for some liberation. If there is too much suffering, if it's overwhelming, as it sometimes is for human beings, it's devastating, it's crushing, it's really hard to find enough breathing room to start to practice. On the other hand, if things are too comfortable, too pleasant, too luxurious, we don't have the motivation to search, not the motivation to seek. So it's the right kind of balance in this pasture of the world that sets the stage for this whole spiritual journey. So the next line is that I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull. So it's this constant searching, this never-ending pushing aside. Where is that bull? And what does the bull represent? Last week I talked about it representing an aspect of our practice, but it's often thought of representing our true nature, really the Dharma nature, the Buddha nature, enlightenment, the awakening to our true selves. But at this stage, we're not really even, don't have a clear picture of what that really looks like, what that means, or what that the ramifications for our lives, what that actually has for us. So we're not even seeing the ox. We're not even so clear about where it is, because we're going this way and that way, and there's like no clue. There's no hint of where that ox is. We're just seeing everything where it isn't. So this brings to mind the search for happiness that we often have, that searching for lasting fulfillment and peace and ease, or the movement, or the searching to avoid our pain, to avoid our suffering. And our normal strategies are a bit like this first picture, that we're looking endlessly through the tall grasses, endlessly trying to find, where is that happiness that I'm seeking? I try this strategy and this strategy and this strategy, and each one of them seems to fail, seems to fall away. It's the worldly winds that we talked about in December, that we hope to try to get those four positive ones of gain, of praise, of fame, and what's the other one? Fame, blame, fame. It's hard to do. That was a positive, but the, you know, the gain, the fame, the pleasure, and the sense of being praised. You know, that's what we think, that's where my happiness lies. So I'm going to seek those. I'm going to avoid the pain and the blame and the disrepute and the loss. So how can I avoid those ones? But yet, you know, as we all know, the things we hold so dear to our lives eventually will go. Well, eventually we either be taken away from us, or we will lose them, or ourselves will change. So it becomes, you know, we can start to get a sense, especially the more we practice, and we stop kind of being caught in the illusion of seeking, you start to realize this strategy I'm using isn't working out. Same thing with the pain side of it, the suffering side. Because sometimes we're more oriented to avoiding pain. Sometimes we're more oriented to finding that peace and happiness. So Ajahn Chah had a beautiful way of describing this that I've read before, but I'll read it again. So the Buddha once saw a jackal, a wild dog, run out of the forest where he was staying. It stood still for a while, then ran into the underbrush, and then out again. Then it ran into a tree hollow, then out again. Then it went into a cave, only to run out again. 1 minute it stood, the next it ran, then it lay down, then it jumped up. Does that sound familiar at all to your life? Like, okay, I'm looking here, I'm looking there. I just can't quite find that perfect place. I can't find that place where finally I don't have to move anymore, because everything is sufficient. Everything is met. This is this deep hunger that we're searching for through those tall grasses. So the jackal had the mange. So the mange is this skin condition that you don't see so much in our Western developed country, but you know it's skin disease. It's a parasite that's eating into the skin. So when the jackal stood, the mange would eat into its skin, so it would run. Running, it was still uncomfortable, so it would stop. Standing, it was still uncomfortable, so it would lie down. Then it would jump up again, running to the underbrush, the tree hollow, never staying still. The Buddha said, "Monks, do you see that jackal this afternoon? Standing, it suffered. Running, it suffered. Sitting, it suffered. Lying down, it suffered. It blamed standing for its discomfort. It blamed sitting. It blamed running and lying down. It blamed the tree, the underbrush, and the cave. In fact, the problem was with none of those things. The problem was with his mange. He was carrying it on his back in his very skin. No matter where he went, he could not escape that. He could never find the end to that." And this is such a vivid and also very direct teaching of the mange that we all carry. And yet we're searching through the grass. And this first picture of the Oxfording pictures captures that searching, that fruitless searching for peace, for happiness, for the end of our suffering. Because we're looking in all, what's the song go, looking for love in all the wrong places. We're just not finding where that is. Because we have that bewilderment, we have that confusion, that delusion. And Ajahn Chah concludes this with saying, "Our mange is not understanding right view, not understanding the nature of dukkha, the origination of dukkha, and the cessation of dukkha." So this is kind of the predicament that we find ourselves in. So the next line in this verse is, "Following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains." You get a sense of that you're following unnamed rivers, you're not sure where they're going. There's these paths that are just crisscrossing all over the place. And there are these distant mountains that seem so vast, like it's an endless search. So we're lost. We're confused about where to go, not sure how to find what actually brings happiness, what actually brings the release of our suffering, the release of our struggle. So this picture, you know, this is how I'm, you know, kind of inviting us to interpret it, but find your own own way through it. It really shows this level of struggle, this level of fruitless searching. And it encapsulates kind of this essential dilemma that we have as human beings. Yeah, so we've kind of talked around it. But from a Buddhist perspective, really the core of that is that there's these three characteristics of dukkha, of impermanence, and of non-self. Right? So that things have an inherent insubstantiality to it. And that creates a level of dukkha, suffering. The fact that everything is in flux, everything is changing, except for one thing, and that's what the Buddha discovered, and we'll get to that later on in this year. But right now we're staying with the struggle. I think it's helpful to feel that struggle, to really take that in. The first noble truth, that there is dukkha. Till we really take that in, there's not the launching of our spiritual practice, our spiritual path. And then anatta, non-self, that there's this illusion of this solid sense of me that is unchanging. And that gets upset, that gets opinionated, that gets hurt, that gets prideful, that experiences the worldly winds. And yet that self is always arising and passing away. It is also subject to impermanence. Now the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, when he was just an ordinary person, he was reflecting on this very dilemma that's represented by this first picture, this endlessly searching, following those unnamed rivers, trying to find where is their happiness through those interpenetrating paths of distant mountains. Where's the release, the escape from the suffering? And he realized that I love this. It's like an aha moment that really brought this wisdom factor into his practice, his path. And that he realized that everything he was looking at for happiness was impermanent, that it was subject to change. So just take that in for yourself. Like every time you look for something to fulfill you, to make you happy, reflect also that that is in flux. That's in a process of arising and a process of falling away and disappearing. And when we try to find something that's lasting in the midst of something that's impermanent, we'll experience suffering. But he said he realized even more profoundly that that's only half the problem. The other half is that he himself was also arising and passing away. He himself was impermanent. That he had this mood one day, another mood another day, or even from hour to hour, moment to moment. He started to see his mind state and his identity arise and then shift back and forth. So he saw that something he himself is impermanent is trying to find happiness in something else that's impermanent. It's hopeless. So this is what this picture kind of brings us right into, that hopeless quality, that sense of futility in our search. But until we realize it's futile, we continue to try it. We keep trying to do these different strategies. And then eventually the Buddha saw in the heavenly messengers, remember those of old age, of sickness and death. When he saw those, that was what kind of spurred this urgency. Because he realized the way he was seeking happiness through, you know, being a very affluent person with many wonderful things, with all of his comforts taken care of. When he realized that that was actually impermanent, it was very shocking to him. He realized that his youthful, healthy body and the youthful, healthy bodies of all those people he was surrounded with, those too will experience sickness. They too experienced old age, and they will all experience death. It was very shocking to him. This is that going into the midst of that struggle, that, you know, wherever I look, I cannot find that. And when the fourth messenger, the one of the monastic, the person who was a seeker, who had given up all their possessions to find, to walk the holy life, that became the step, the first step. That's really where we are in these pictures. We just get a hint of that at the very last line. And the next picture, we start to follow that. And we'll get into that in a minute. Now, so the important thing is to make this yours. to make this from this abstract, interesting story to how do you actually seek happiness in ways that aren't ultimately fulfilling? How do you seek escape from your suffering in a way that doesn't ultimately work? Doesn't actually fix it? And to actually kind of rest in that quality of being not so much rest, but really notice, kind of feel how much struggle there is in that. And this is the next verse. Is my strength failing and my vitality? Gotta get the next page, sorry. My strength failing and my vitality is exhausted. I cannot find the bull. I cannot find that happiness. And we get exhausted by that. But we unfortunately have a lot of endurance as human beings that we can just kind of keep going and going and going until finally we're on our deathbed. And then we finally realize that maybe didn't use my life as well as I could have. So the spiritual journey is in some ways learning to find the fertility of that when there's still time to practice, when there's still time to walk the path. And it doesn't matter how old or young we are. It's just finding it. That's what that matters. And that's the urgency of that and that clarity of intention, understanding right view. That is what becomes the basis of our practice, the basis of our spiritual journey, beginning and deepening and finding its depth. So my strength and feeling and my vitality exhausted, I cannot find the bull. Now this picture, this line of this picture and this whole picture itself points to failure. And this series of pictures actually points to a series of failures that we have on the way of the spiritual practice. But yet those failures are essential. They're essential for us to grow from, to learn from. It's a bit like the hero's journey, that these obstacles often challenge that hero or heroine to the point where they actually become bigger than themselves. They overcome their own limitations. And sometimes the trials are tremendous. So these pictures tend to teach through failure and how that wise failure and that wise struggle actually can lead to wisdom. Because, you know, again, we're kind of stubborn as human beings. We often have to exhaust all the other possibilities. We try this way and try that way. And I think a lot of the power of meditation is it actually teaches you how to see more clearly, to see through your distortion. And without you realizing it, you actually start to see how many dead ends you follow. You actually see those dead ends much more acutely and clearly. And that seeing itself, then that becomes the start of this whole journey. It becomes the next pictures as we move through, seeing the traces of the ox. And there's also this kind of interesting inside joke about all this. And that's the seeking of the ox, the seeking of our true nature, the seeking of our happiness that's unchanging. We go outside, we look everywhere for it except where it actually is. Because we're searching for something that's already inherently what we are and who we are. It's already within us. And yet we search outward for it. We struggle to get it under ropes, to control it, as we see in later in these pictures as we go along. So searching for something outside of ourselves we're already going to have some failure at some point. There's a blues song by two musicians, Sonny Terry and Bronnie McGee, where they're talking about God and man and how they played hide and seek, and God hid someplace and man looked everywhere for God and never found him because God was right inside of him. And there was this, you know, kind of the nice play of the lyrics of this guitarist and harmonicist, a guy who played the harmonica very well, Sonny Terry. But that sense of trial and error, of looking for something that's already right here, that's the kind of cosmic joke that we get to wake up to. And it seems like as human nature, we almost need to learn that the hard way. We have to learn it through my strength failing and my vitality exhausted until we suddenly, something changes. And we see this in again and again in these pictures, you know, as we go through actually seeing the ox and trying to tame the ox. And then there's different important shifts that happen for that releasing of that control or releasing that looking for the separation, looking for your true nature outside of yourself. And struggle itself, I just want to, again, emphasize how important that is. And I think it, particularly in our Western kind of European-infused culture, there's a bit of an intolerance for struggle. Kind of there's an assumption that if you can't do it perfectly right from the beginning, you just don't do it at all. Or there's something wrong with you if you can't do it well right from the start. And my daughter, she's probably never going to hear this, but she was doing a college essay. And one of the questions was, you know, what could be your superpower? And her superpower would be, you know, to be able to do anything at all pretty well from the first go. And then, you know, she could choose to master it or not. But that sense of that, how we just are trained not to to really be with struggle. I was listening to a course on cultural intelligence and how, you know, we have this bias, like the our normal white European culture is the only way, the best way to be in the world. And this course kind of looked at all the different cultural parameters and different ways of dividing that up and just showed how diverse, you know, as a world we are and how we have so much kind of, what do you call it, privilege and bias and also just arrogance that the white culture is the only culture, the best culture. An example that this teacher gave was of a man or somebody observing a classroom in, I believe it was in Japan. And there was a, you know, a younger class, but they were trying to draw a cube on the wall, on the board. And so they all drew it. And one student had a lot of trouble with it. And they had that student come up and actually try to draw it in front of everybody. Now from our, and he failed at it for a long time. Now from a Western standpoint, we think, oh man, that's so shaming. That's so, you know, demoralizing, because that's kind of our echo that we bring with that sense of not succeeding right away. But yet when that student finally completed it, the whole class applauded, because in that culture, there's a, again, the way it was presented, that there's an appreciation for the struggle itself. The struggle itself is praiseworthy, and the persistence that comes from that. And so this came originally from Chinese Buddhism, so it has that flavor of valuing struggle. And so just to encourage us to be willing to be in the midst of that struggle a bit, to actually feel that, to stay with that first noble truth that there is dukkha before we rush to the third noble truth and the cessation of it. Let me really feel that dukkha. Let me feel that struggle. Let me feel the futility through my open eyes of the way I try to find happiness that's unchanging. Now, the final verse of this is that I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night. It's I only hear the locusts chirping through the forests at night. So the whole thing right now is in the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the bull, following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing and my vitality exhausted. I cannot find the bull. Can't find what I'm seeking. But all I can hear is these locusts chirping in the breeze through the forest. Only hear the locusts. And so right there, this is where that call comes in, that subtle call that there's another way. So this picture is showing the exhausting of all the other pathways, all the other possibilities, searching here, searching there. And you hear, there's this subtle, you don't even recognize it as the sign. You don't even recognize it as something that's leading you toward where you want to go. But it is. It becomes, so you almost discount it. And so this is again, an invitation to see it in our own practice, to see where we struggle. And some of us, you know, are very new at practice and we're kind of in the midst of a lot of our struggle. And, you know, this is can feel very, you know, very pertinent. But I want to call out, or, you know, maybe call attention to those who are very experienced and how we kind of, like, why do I keep doing these same patterns? I've been practicing for all these years and yet these same patterns come up. So this is an invitation to notice how that deep perspective, how that deep perspective might still be there of where happiness really is. And to kind of feel that failure of the direction that you have been going. To remember that quote from Ajahn Chah about the jackal, to really feel where your view may be distorted, may not be fully right or fully wise, not fully understanding the Four Noble Truths. So the locusts chirping in the night, the subtle call. So if the ox represents this spiritual journey and the start of it, you know, and how it starts to emerge out of all these other possibilities that we so often find, how do we find that lasting happiness? How do we find a release of our suffering, of our contraction of heart? And it can represent really this beginning of our spiritual practice. And even if we've been practicing for many, many years, we often cycle through these pictures. It can be that, you know, that confusion arises. We just don't know where to go when we're in that place of doubt, that place of confusion. Feel that a little bit, open to that. Value the experience of suffering and what it can teach you. And then the path starts to unfold. All right, well, let's just sit quietly for a couple of moments, and then I'm going to talk about the homework. All right, so there's the homework kind of all condensed there. It has the main piece, and then there's the verse underneath that. And I saw that someone asked for a link to the actual images, and we have that on our website. Let me pull it up. Actually, Cheryl, if you're there, if you could link that up, it would probably be faster if you did it for us. And we have a page that we're developed around that. So a little bit tweaking going on, but that should work. So searching for the ox. So reflecting on all the ways you seek happiness and peace in which you don't ultimately succeed, that doesn't actually bring that quality of lasting, unchanging peace and unchanging restriction. Or, okay, we can't send it off quite yet, so we'll wait on. We'll get the pictures out soon, so we just hang out there. I guess. Oh, okay. I see. Never mind. I'm trying to juggle too many things. Okay, so here is the link to the pictures. Okay, so back to the homework. So. Basically, I talked about this a lot during the talk, is to just start to reflect on all the ways that you've tried to seek happiness. And even you can reflect on it just kind of by itself, but also just when you find yourself in the midst of it, like, okay, I really want to get that mocha this morning. I really want to get, you know, watch that TV show. Just pause for a minute or two and just feel that wanting. Feel that sense of lack that you're trying to fulfill. And sometimes you may find that you can follow that down to this real deep, almost existential lack. And that this mocha is a superficial, you know, futile attempt at filling it that fills it for a little bit, but not very long. And then you go ahead and get the mocha or watch the show. I'm not, you know, asking you to deprive yourself or to become austere, but simply to start to learn from that And same thing with avoiding pain, avoiding discomfort. You know, you can feel that sitting. If you sit, trying to sit still and your body starts to hurt and how you want to fidget, or you're on a Zoom call and I think I'm going to, you know, you want to get up and get a tea or something. See if you can just pause a little bit with the impulse to move and see, you know, really what's, see that impulse to try to alleviate suffering. Recall that jackal that's moving all over the place. Recall this image of going through the tall grasses, searching for that, that's that happiness, that peace. And what lessons does the fruitful struggle, the fruitless, oops, I said fruitful struggle, it should be fruitless struggle. Fruitless struggle teach us. We'll correct that for the website. Yeah, what does that teach you to have that, to really take that in, to use your meditation training to let you see more clearly how most of our strategies don't really work. And by doing this, you might start to find a deeper aspiration start to arise. Because the Buddha didn't say there's one noble truth and that's it. There's dukkha and tough luck. He said there's dukkha and there's the origination of it, and there's a cessation of it. So then by really connecting with the dukkha in your life, again, not in it, don't be overwhelmed by it. Don't become too heavy with it, but just curiously noticing, sobering up to your strategies. It starts to become this aspiration for really finding the path that the Buddha took, the path that this ox herding pictures represents. All right, so that's enough words from me. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are, how you're landing with this, and you know, if, and you can also welcome to talk about your practice. So I'll give you permission to unmute if you like. Yes, and you can either raise your hand or just unmute is either way fine. Okay, Iris, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I feel like I'm really starting to get the first noble truth, and not in a heavy duty way. I mean, sure, there's heavy duty stuff in my life, but just in that sort of, you know, in that every moment, not quite right, you know, a little discomfort here and there and a thought or this or that. And it's not depressing. It's just, yeah, this, it's, and then the understanding of, you know, seeing how I look and continue to have these habits of looking for happiness, satisfaction, comfort in ways that are momentary. And what I notice more and more that's encouraging is as soon as I become, as soon as I identify or have a plan or going to do something or I did something or look at me or blah, blah, like an uncomfortable feeling is in my chest. Mm-hmm. And I realize it's because I'm trying to hold on to something that, yeah, that isn't helpful. And like seeing that, and, you know, it might take a few seconds or more for that unpleasant feeling to pass, but just seeing that allows an opening and more realization of that, you know, the happiness that we're learning about through the Buddha's teachings, you know, is not doing in the way, you know, I mean, not that I shouldn't do anything. Of course, we have to do things, but, you know, not identifying with everything and make it about me.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That's the doing that that you're talking about is not so much of the lack of action in the world, but the doing that's really tied to that identification. And you just gave a really nice description of this way we can personalize the Four Noble Truths, you know, because we can hold it like, oh, okay, there's all this stuff, but to actually see it really real time in the way that you contract around things, the way that you, sorry, that screen just shifted. Sometimes Zoom shifts and like I'm making eye contact and suddenly you're gone. That's a little disorienting. So sorry, that's why I kind of did that for a second there. But I see you again. So that personalization of really seeing it real time, how something arises and there's that contraction of clinging of really that selfing around it. I mean, you're describing that when you take it personally, that's what makes the problem. So, you know, seeking, you know, sense pleasure, seeking enjoyment, as long as we hold that it's also impermanent and we also don't identify with it, there's no problem at all. There's no problem at all. But as soon as we have even a little bit of that identification, like, wow, I'm so, you know, special because I have this happening, right? Then you're feeling that deeper contraction. That's feeling that deeper experience of dukkha. And that's so important. It's taking it from the superficial dukkha of like, oh, I lost that or this is happening, but to feel it really on that really subtle level. And I think that's really a fruitful place to keep practicing, to see that subtleness, because then you start to, your mindfulness allows you to see more and more clearly, you know, what choices you make, how you engage or not engage. You're learning, you know, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, what, you know, wise action, what leads to suffering, what's the release of that suffering. And just one more piece to highlight that you said, you know, notice you have, you know, these big things in your life, but noticing in the small ways, it's like I said early on in the talk, that human existence, that's not too much suffering, not too much pleasure. There's that sweet spot. And there, you know, we all experience sometimes a higher percentage of those really overwhelming times. And it can be harder to find, you know, the footing in the practice. Sometimes it's just the dukkha is so intense, you just have no other way, other choice than other than to turn toward this, to release. And like some of our modern day mystics like Brian Cady and Eckhart Tolle, that's part of their journey, is that just their dukkha became so overwhelming that they saw deep wisdom came from that. And sometimes it leads to, you know, devastation and overwhelm and collapse. So finding that sweet spot, I think, allows us to recognize it in the bigger situation. So that's a lot of great sharing there, Arias. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Maddie?
Yeah, Maddie. Hey, Tim. Really like this homework. And I think I have a related question to what you're talking about with Iris. I with this homework, I've, over the past, I don't know, year of my practice, have kind of started to do this a little naturally where, you know, when I'm reaching for, I don't know, like I want to buy something new or whatever thing, get frustrated at work and I want to scroll in the news, like noticing those. And noticing that, but not like depriving myself of them. But I guess my question is about the value of like these, you know, the small noticing rather than the like, no, like I know these things are like, you know, often just contributing to my suffering and maybe I should just sell my house and move to the woods. which, you know, I don't think I'm particularly close to doing, but sometimes, you know, I'm like, am I just making an excuse that like, you know, these small moments of noticing are actually worthwhile versus like, you know, maybe more drastic actions actually needed to reduce suffering. And yeah, I don't know. I've been kind of chewing on that for a while. And so this homework makes well with that. I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great reflection. It's, you know, that subtle seeing, that seeing this, the level, small level of it, if it's seen deeply enough, it should start to translate into how we act in the world. If it's not, there may be something we're not quite seeing, or we may need, as you said, more drastic measures around it. And, you know, that's where, you know, the practice of renunciation can sometimes be very helpful. And so you can play with it like, okay, for the next, let's say, you know, just to use your example, like going online and searching for something that you want, let's say you, you know, and you do that whatever frequency, let's just say you do it every day. You probably don't do it every day, but let's say you do. Let's say for the next week, I'm not going to do that. And so then suddenly, you know, you have the you still have the impulse, but without the release of doing it. And so ideally, you don't use it as a kind of a white knuckle exercise of how can I just, you know, will myself through that period, but actually start to feel it more acutely, that deeper lack that is driving all that, that deeper sense of insufficiency. In my own life, I mean, I kind of have an interesting mix of craving and aversion, you know, in terms of like the personality types. And sometimes I get really in a craving mode, but I've noticed that for some reason those just start to fall away. They're it's almost like a dry firing, you know, hopefully this isn't offensive to anybody. Like if you have a gun and you pull the trigger without a bullet in it, there's nothing that happens from that. But yet, you know, so often, you know, we pull the trigger, there's a big explosion. That's like the trigger. I want something, I get it, and I feel that hit of satisfaction. But then at some point it shifts. So it's like you kind of find yourself going through the motions, but it's all empty. There's nothing something is missing in that. Some link was somehow dissolved or broken or released. And you're even not even sure what happened there. And so that's where some of those small moments, they start to add up. As long as they're used as small moments to go deep, I think that's the big thing. And when I say deep, it's like to the point where you kind of get a little existentially uncomfortable. It's like, well, if I'm not wanting, what am I? That kind of a thing. Or feeling like, well, this lack is so deep, it's so primal that nothing could actually fill this. And then you start to realize, well, maybe that lack, you know, I don't want to take your struggle away in the joy of discovery, but sometimes you realize that lack is actually, that's what the whole practice is about resolving, is in that sense of separation. I look out and see you and me as separate beings. There's an inherent lack in that. And if we try to fill it through all these different ways, but at some point when we actually see that release of that separation, then that lack falls away.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, I like the point of using these small things to build to something larger. Yeah, going deep with the small moments. And if it's only the small moments ever and not progressing to anything deeper, then maybe be a little more, effort is needed or something.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it might be more effort, or it's probably more clarity is needed around it. And what you might try doing is a great practice is writing. Is writing about it, you know, is to, you know, have just take something simple that you're wanting and then kind of notice what comes up and what it represents and actually write it out. And that already makes you much more, you have to clearly articulate it. You have to see yourself writing it out. You have to actually know it. And sometimes that allows a deeper seeing. It's like what we do in the dyads when someone says, okay, where's the lack now? Where's the lack now? And you just kind of, that repeating, gentle repeating question allows you to drop down deeper and deeper. And it's a journey of exploration, and it ideally leads someplace that's unexpected, that you weren't. Like, unexpected means it shows you some part of your way you're holding the world and yourself in that world that you didn't realize. And it often leads to a quality of stillness, a quality of you feel that this thing's quieting down. While going the other direction, the wanting, it just, you know, the mind just loves that and just keeps churning on it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right. Anyone else like to share anything or ask anything?
Tim, I'm thinking about how lovely the word endlessly is in that verse. And like you were saying, how often I want to, and both these questions that people asked, Iris and Maddie, made me think about it more. Like I just want to skip over the arising of it and get to the end of it instead of just sinking into this, the endlessly. And the writer doesn't even say seemingly endless. And I imagine that was probably deliberate, endlessly searching.
That's right. And until we really see the endless quality of it, it's easy to kind of stay in that, you know, that searching. It's like, well, maybe this time will work. Maybe this time will work. And even more pertinent to the spiritual journey is that unless that strategy is really seen, it carries over into our, how we practice, how we meditate, how we approach the whole practice. And you actually see that played out in these pictures that, you know, there's this early stage where, you know, this person representing us gets more clarity, but then there's a strategy that he tends to use right from the beginning, you know, of control, of trying to make this work. And at some point, you know, he releases that. We release that. And so that's the other benefit of really seeing this, the endless quality of it, the fertility of it. And then we start to hone more and more to really what's really right action, what's really the path that leads to really releasing. And it goes someplace that we is unexpected, you know, from our normal perspective. Yeah, so thank you, Kava, for sharing that. Anyone else like to share anything? I see there's a chat. Let me see if I can convey it. Okay, so let me just read that and see if I can capture it. So I'm tapping into this sense of adventure. The person is a little humorous too in his innocence and ignorance. I also see it is not okay to be how I am right now. I must improve, move, inner jackal, and find the right trail. Yeah, that's exactly. There's that. That's the seeking of these trails, and you know, giving that image of the person kind of lost in the woods, like, oh, maybe this trail leads, and you might get excited about it because you see. Think there's something up there that's going to finally be the ticket, the final thing. And then also wake up to the fertility of trying to save people and lead, you know, and lead them to happiness. So that's also, you know, part of that is our trying to help people skip over their own suffering, their own dukkha. I think it's a hard thing, especially for parents and for so many of us who have caring hearts. I remember when my daughter was young and had some very minor thing happen, like a crayon broke or something like that. She was really upset about it. I could feel a part of me that wanted her to never experience another broken crayon in her life. But another part of me realized, you know, that's a disservice to her. She has to learn how to experience dukkha, to how to experience impermanence, experience loss, and how to find her own way through that. And each person has to find their own way. And going back to last year with boundaries and all that, and my therapist used to say, you have to be willing to let people learn their lessons at their own pace. And that's really hard. We want to drag them through kicking and screaming to show them the right way to be in the world and how to find their happiness. But it's really, we have to walk this our own path. We can be supports for each other. We can be, you know, kind. We can be, you know, really good allies, good companions on this path. But it's really something we all have to walk ourselves eventually. And then also, the question is around also see how listening is occurring. To know with curiosity, one shuts out the other. And that's a good point that it is really the art, meditations are listening more clearly to really see what's here and learning to see where we cause, you know, unfruitful searching, unfruitful to release our suffering. Okay, Mark, wait, come on.
Hey, can y'all hear me?
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. Nice to see you. And it's good to just see everybody here. I love to see all these beautiful faces. Hope everybody's doing well. I really, really love this practice and reflection piece right here. And I know, like, at least a part of my practice lately, and it's actually it's been happening for months and months, just like in terms of like searching for this ox and sometimes realizing like that what we're trying to do is futile. It can be so sobering where like I would just get these energetic states of like not apathy, not like not nothing matters, but it's just like, oh my God, like are we just beating our head against a wall? Oh my God, dang, man. Like that, yeah, that can be really tough. And even in, I mean, like, I can't speak for everyone else, but even in that groundlessness, like, I still have this, like this urge to just find something that's like grounded. And you know, now, like, I've crossed over into like, you know, like values-based living. And it's almost still an attempt. Like I'm starting to realize this is still a subconscious, at least for me, I feel like it's a subconscious attempt to try to find something that, that you can stand on. So I frequently struggle with this all the time. And I thought like there'd be like a certain point in your practice where you get to move on with this. Nah, I just think this is so interesting. So interesting. That's all I want to share. Yeah,
that's great. And I think you articulated well that quality of, you know, just it can really be over, you know, I don't want to say overwhelming, but it can be overwhelming just how everything that we're trying to do doesn't ultimately work very well. And it's, you know, you start to reflect on how everyone around you is doing the same thing. And sometimes they're even more off. They're even going further away from what, because sometimes we're kind of getting a little close to, you know, some peace and some ease, but still we can see the futility in it when we really look closely. But this is the whole point of these ox herding pictures. And this is where there's such a profound shift about, I don't know, the sixth week when he rides the ox home and after he lets go of the ox. Because that's when he tap into really, there's a much deeper seeing of what the real problem is, the ultimate problem is. And until we see that, all this stuff we do is going to be kind of inherently not going to work. But once we see that inherent problem and we start to see the way through that, then suddenly all the different things we've been trying suddenly start to make sense and actually start to work. You start to see, oh, those are all skillful. As long as there's this, and really the linchpin is around that the deep unconscious belief in self. I mean, that's the linchpin, because that's very subtle. It's very profound. It's very all permeating. And we take that self as always trying to do this and that. And as long as that self is there, we're going to experience dukkha. I mean, the dependent origination. If there's a self, there's going to be dukkha. That's the bottom line. And so that self can be very subtle. It can be very polished up. It can be, you know, doing this really skillful thing, and yet what you're sensing is that deep quality of insubstantiality there, that because we're trying to make something that's inherently empty something solid. And until we realize that, you know, then there's going to be that sense of futility, that sense of banging my head in the wall. But once you see that, then there's this really, that's where the last picture is in these series, is that the person goes back into the marketplace. They come back with this inner perspective of emptiness, and they live, they interact, they be with people, they see some things like that are very skillful, like some of the things you're practicing and working on. It's like, okay, that, like you said, value-based living, suddenly that's infused with this deep inner sense of stillness. And so suddenly you can see, wow, this actually has a lot of skill and efficacy with it. You know, and so then we start to see that self is just something that arises, but we don't have to identify with it. And then we see, oh, it's arising now and it's passing away now. But that's not what I am. That's not who I am. That's those pictures of connecting with the source. So this is big territory, but it's a beautiful journey and a way of exploring it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing. All right, so I lost track of who was next. So let's go with Kathy, and then we'll go with Belle.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Some of what you just answered, Marquise, is I think where I'm headed, but I'm wondering, I'm just puzzled if we have this Buddha nature within us, if we're going to look within, how we get so, if you could comment on this, how we get so far away from it? What's the if, you know, if we already have it, how did it get away from us?
It's a big question, isn't it? You know, how did that happen? And you know, it's almost you know, I have to feel into that. I don't have a real, this is the way, you know, this is the answer for sure, but this is what comes to mind right now. And I may have a different answer if you ask this next week, but it's a little bit like that. It's like, you look at a young child, for example, and how there's that, you know, before they're self-conscious, there's kind of a certain ease. You know, if they have a life that's more or less comfortable, that they have support, they're not being abused or neglected, all those things. If they're basically loved, it can often be just this delight of being really engaged in wonder with the world, right? And, you know, there's no self-consciousness. And at some point we become conscious. And that consciousness, then we start to worry about how people are perceiving us and then how we're supposed to be in the world. How do we get love? How do we avoid pain? You know, all those things, you know, start to come up. And depending on how, you know, how difficult or it's traumatic or whatever culture you grow up or family, sometimes that gets really hardened into trauma responses and these really strong patterns. Even if you have a basic healthy family, we can still have these very, you know, neurotic tendencies that arise. You know, that's just part of our humanness. So it's almost like we have, but until we kind of go through that forming that sense of self and learning how to navigate that, releasing the self doesn't really have much perspective. It's because in that early stage, when we're just little children, we're not conscious of the fact that they're not conscious of the fact that there's no separation. They're just living it, but there's not that perspective. And so as we grow up and mature, you know, then when we awaken, there's that perspective. We know, oh yeah, we know that, we see that. And so it's like awareness knowing awareness, whether it's just awareness when we were young children. And so, you know, for most of us, if not all of us, we have to go through that phase of almost developmentally first becoming a healthy, intact person, or at least be able to navigate our sense of self. So it's relaxed enough, it's okay enough. And then there's that deeper releasing. If we try to skip over that, you know, that stage, sometimes there's the spiritual bypassing that happens.
Oh, and that's so it's helpful.
It's a pretty part of the journey, and it's, I mean, not to get into a comparative religion process, but maybe that's part of what happened at, you know, the Garden of Eden, that there's this place of deep innocence and connection with the divine, and then knowledge came in, you know, and the knowledge of separation of me and you. Or at the very beginning, there is one and there is two. That's pointing toward the same thing that we're exploring as Dharma practitioners, is that unity to separation, and how that itself, then that becomes back into unity. And that's the journey. That's the maturation of our practice.
Thank you, Tim. It's fantastic. I never thought before of being self-conscious, which I'm acutely aware of, with this Buddhist concept of self. I never connected those two.
That's right. That's really, yeah, so thinking. Then, you know, the deepening of the practice is that you're still aware of yourself, but you don't take it personally. You see that, you know, that, yeah, there's a self here, but there's also the truth of it is that there's an emptiness. And so instead of that, you know, that terror about how you're being judged or perceived and, you know, all that, it kind of passes through. Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. Okay, so Belle? Belly?
Hi, Bill.
Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. My first time. And
you're welcome.
Thank you. And new to this SIT group, but I'm really digging the fact that I'm relating to tonight's theme and lesson. But I am kind of in this place right now where, okay, so I know that I cannot just be ignorantly, blissfully happy all the time, right? Like that's not going to, I know that that's not going to be the case. I know that there is going to be struggle. So I don't expect to avoid struggle. I don't think that that's what I do. I understand appreciation for it. And I know that things are impermanent. So, right. So things are going to always be shifting, but I have to admit that there is this like need for rest, you know, need for rest from, you know, going from one to the other or just taking what's being given to me or, you know, like enjoying for the quick moment what I've got and then, you know, just being let down again when it no longer makes me happy or when it's no longer there for me. So, and I don't know, I may have just answered my question because I know one of the homework questions is, you know, what are the ways that we seek happiness and peace? I don't know if it's something that can be sought, you know, like I know that we can be it, right? Like meditation and those can give us moments of peace, but it's like, how can we find our way through just kind of that inner angst that happens when we go, you know, through this hero's journey? That it's the angst, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So it's, you know, so there's a lot of nuances to what you're talking about. You know, on one hand, there's kind of the overall direction of the practice, which is towards trying to find where that sense of happiness that's not based in conditions. Where right. does that lie? You know, where does that feel like? And that in itself, when we actually start to see that and discover it, it inherently is much more at peace. It's much more at rest. There's often a sense of not needing to do anything with the moment because it's naturally sufficient. So that's kind of the deepening of the practice. But the another part of your question, if I heard it right, was like, you know, how do you, you know, get from here to there? How do you deal with all the angst and all the difficulty of things? And so that's the skill of, you know, that we cultivate as meditators, the skillful means. And so like with, you know, so part of it is being willing to give yourself that respite. Sometimes if things are really turbulent, just spending some time meditating, feeling just the breath, you know, letting go of all the worry as much as you can. Sometimes it's more of the direction of turning toward to understand the worry more clearly. So then you see through it and it doesn't grip you as much. You know, sometimes it's doing more conscious cultivation things like, okay, I'm going to practice generosity or reflect on generosity or, you know, offer loving kindness to myself and others. So it's like there's so many ways that shows up, you know, I kind of have to need more specifics to kind of dial it in for you. But that's, you know, that's the whole practice. And it's really important because otherwise we're overwhelmed. We're exhausted. And because life is hard. It has all these bumps, all these difficulties, all these cliffs that we almost fall off or sometimes do fall off of.
Yeah. No, definitely. I knew that wasn't going to be like, give me the answer in one word. But I think that's it. Like, I, you know, like if, you know, I think, you know, Marcus kind of hit it. Like, it's like this, it's really interesting to me. But, you know, if I'm finding that what makes me happy right now is having those moments of rest, like having a feeling of peace. And I know that that's hard to come by, you know, kind of it's hard to not feel like I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's moments of peace. So they, you know, part of like this picture from this perspective we're exploring is to see all the ways it doesn't work. It doesn't come. But you start to see times that it does, like, oh, you know, some shift of perspective, some way of shift of relating to this, how I'm relating to my own self or to someone else, that leads to that moment of peace. And you start to string those together and they start to form kind of more of a cohesive picture of where that is. That's where these next pictures lead to. You start to see the glimpses of the ox. You start to see the ox, you know, and then you start to actually try to tackle that ox.
Thank you,
Belle. Thank you all for your sharing and your questions. It really helps, you know, everyone engage with it, not only yourself, but everyone who hears that, because your questions often mirror other people's experience. And thank you all for your engagement. And next week we'll have a discussion so we can continue to unpack and explore this. And week after that, another talk and go even deeper into this. So I look forward to hearing how you're doing it, exploring it. And if you're drawn to do any kind of artistic exploration, feel free to do that and maybe even share it on our last week together. All right, you're welcome to unmute to say goodbye.